Indonesia is battling a severe COVID outbreak, and Indonesians are angry.
The reports saying everything is okay, we still have oxygen, but on the ground, in the reality, it's the other way around.
Also today, Ben & Jerry's takes a stand. It's not going to sell its ice cream in Israeli settlements. Israeli lawmakers are punching back hard.
I have to tell you, Israeli politicians have reacted as if the country were under the threat of war, more or less.
I'm Marco Werman, and we look back on past Olympic sports. An event like plunge for distance just didn't seem Olympic.
Yeah, it's pretty kind of boring watching somebody just floating along the surface, you know?
Not boring, the Bucks and Six and celebrating the Greek Freak in Athens today. That's all coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The weather this summer has been unreal, but the destruction it's brought shows in no uncertain terms that the future is here.
The death toll from flooding in Western Europe is mounting as rescue workers scramble to clear debris.
This fire is burning uncontained, and it's jumping from tree to tree.
The smoke is actually still rising from the homes in
there. Right now we're fighting versus fire. We need more help. We need the nation.
Floods in Western Europe, wildfires across the West and North America, and in Siberia, one headline quoting a local there, everything is on fire. China is also feeling the pain. Massive floods are affecting millions of people. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai and says the worst-hit areas are in the city of Zhangzhou and surrounding Henan province in central China.
Throughout the province, there's about 10 cities and urban and rural areas that have been affected. But because Zhengzhou is a city about 10 million, it's getting a lot of attention. And there's been a lot of footage on social media about the situation in Zhengzhou. But actually, it's been around the region. So about 100,000 people had to be relocated because of the flood. And this has been going on for several days now, since Saturday.
So there's some really dramatic scenes showing up on social media. What have you been seeing?
One video that I got sent from someone I know who's living there showed just how scary this kind of flooding can be. So the woman filming this video, she's live streaming and she's pointing it at the street, which is just covered in water and it looks like a river. And she's saying, oh my gosh, there's a father and his child are just swept away. Swept right down the street by the floodwaters. So she's just yelling at them, please hold on to something, but there's nothing that they can hold on to. And the water is about the level of the hood of the cars on the side of the street. But the video that I've been seeing all over the internet is this one, which was shot in one of Zhengzhou's subway cars on Tuesday night.
And what's going on there, Rebecca?
What's happening is you're seeing the inside of a subway car. Everybody inside the subway car is sort of grabbing onto those strap hangers, and the water is all the way up to their chest, almost up to their shoulders. It's dark in the subway car, and it's just very scary because you can imagine they were there for several hours before they were able to be evacuated out, and 12 people died.
That's incredible. I mean, China does have a long history of floods, but this is really exceptional, heaviest in centuries, according to experts. What do they think is going on here? Does it have to do with climate change or development or what?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of rainfall in this region that doesn't usually get a whole lot of rainfall. So the amount of rain in 3 days is the same amount as they usually get in a year. So yes, China does have problems with flooding, but that's usually related to rivers or on the coastal areas. But this flooding is happening in an inland area of China. So I don't think they have very much experience with flooding.
Finally, Rebecca, I mean, it's a ton of rain in recent days. What is the forecast like right now? Is this going to get worse?
They say that today rainfall was much less. There was a sort of a brief moment with a torrential downpour, but the rest of the day there was much less rain. But looking at social media, you know, it's been really striking to see how much the public all around China is trying to respond in a helpful way. People are offering to send, you know, money or send aid or sending useful information over the internet. So I think, I mean, it's really striking a chord with Chinese people all over the country.
The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai. Thank you very much for this.
Thank you.
The Delta variant of the coronavirus is currently tearing through Indonesia. The island nation is now reporting around 50,000 cases a day, the most of any country in the world. As Ashley Westerman reports, many Indonesians are angry that they're in this position more than a year after the pandemic began.
Andreas Harsono says the air around his apartment in central Jakarta, Indonesia's capital, is filled with the sounds of death all day and all night.
You will hear ambulance hearses, wing, wing, wing. There are many mosques here. Every time someone died, they will announce it. You can hear it. Assalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Harsono, who works for Human Rights Watch, is actually recovering from COVID. Both he and his wife caught it earlier this month, even though they were both fully vaccinated with China's Sinovac. Their 10-year-old daughter also got it.
I was very close to being hospitalized. And if you are hospitalized, you will end up in the ICU. And very likely, you end up in the cemetery.
When first diagnosed, Harsono's local hospital was so packed that he couldn't even sign up for a virtual doctor consultation. He had to go to a community physician instead to get medicine and recover at home. His story is not unique in Indonesia.
People are angry. People are frustrated.
Harsono says the government's handling of the pandemic has become a human rights issue.
Because the government has the responsibility to be transparent, to be truthful, giving regular information to the public. The Indonesian government has failed to do that.
Irma Hidiana is the co-founder of Lapor COVID-19, a group that helps the government shape pandemic policy. She says there is a huge gap between the government's messaging and reality, especially when it comes to the buckling healthcare system.
The reports saying everything is okay, we still have oxygen, we still have wheelchair, we still have a bed for the patients. But on the ground, in the reality, it's the other way around.
Hidiana says nearly all hospital beds, particularly on the main island of Java and the popular tourist island of Bali, are full. Epidemiologists say the Delta variant depletes oxygen faster than other variants, and hospitals are running low on that too. She says when people are turned away, they try to take care of themselves at home, and many die.
Around 700 people died since June 1st up to now. So it's quite shocking, and the number is quite big too.
The vaccine rollout in Indonesia has been very slow. Critics say the efforts have been hamstrung by bureaucracy and unnecessary procedures and tests. For instance, taking people's blood pressure before getting the jab. The government says these requirements are needed to prevent negative vaccine side effects. To date, Indonesia has only vaccinated a little over 6% of its population of 280 million. A majority of those vaccines have come from China. Epidemiologist Dicky Budiman at Griffith University in Australia says these shots have proven to be less effective against the Delta variant.
So far, still the government put this vaccination program as their main strategy to dealing with the pandemic, which is, we know this is not correct.
He says increased testing should be the government priority because without it, there's no real way to tell how many people are actually infected. Budiman says the outlook is not good.
We cannot escape from the current projection, which is the peak will happen end of this July. And the number is like maybe around 200,000 or 300,000 cases a day.
Indonesia does have some restrictions in place, though it hasn't gone into a full lockdown. Government officials say that would be bad for the economy. Still, the economy has taken a hit from the partial lockdowns and travel restrictions the government has implemented. Indra Sugito is a tour guide in Yogyakarta, the country's religious and cultural hub popular with tourists.
The situation in the first year pandemic is totally have a big damage.
Sugito says in March 2020, before the pandemic really took hold, he made a little over $1,000 a month. But in March of this year, he only made about $68. Still, even though he'd like his business back, Sugito says he's seen many friends and neighbors die.
They die because they don't have access to get the medicine in Indonesia. It's too difficult to get the medicine.
That lack of medicine, along with other tools needed to fight the pandemic, is a reality, experts say, that's unlikely to change anytime soon. For The World, I'm Ashley Westerman.
Wild jubilation in Milwaukee last night. The Milwaukee Bucks snagged their first NBA championship in 50 years, powered by their Greek-Nigerian superstar MVP, Giannis Adekunpo, a.k.a. the Greek Freak because of his off-the-charts athleticism. Adekunpo was born and raised in Greece. Today, the world's Lydia Manolidou visited the Athens neighborhood, where Adekunpo got his humble and uneasy start.
In the Sepolia neighborhood in Athens this morning, cafe owner Yannis Tsikas is elated but exhausted. Tsikas tells me he didn't sleep very much last night because he was hosting a viewing party for the NBA Finals here at his cafe. The game started around 4 a.m. Athens time. And the Tokumbo's old neighbors and friends huddled around a TV wearing jerseys with his name. A local TV station captured the moment when the match was called, a little before 7 in the morning. Tsikas, the cafe owner, and his wife cheer and tear up as they pop champagne. When I catch up with Tsikas a few hours after the party's over, he stands in front of a wall that's completely decked out with all things on the Tokumbo: jerseys, pictures, signed basketballs, and other knickknacks. He tells me all of this is so surreal, and he's still processing it. Tsikas has known Adetokounmpo since the player was a little kid. The basketball court where he started shooting hoops is right across the street from this cafe. Tsikas says today many Greeks are celebrating Adetokounmpo, calling him our kid, our son, embracing him as one of their own. But that wasn't always the case. Adetokounmpo is the son of Nigerian immigrants, and even though he was born in Greece, he didn't get citizenship. For nearly his whole life here, he didn't have any papers because of laws that make it nearly impossible for people who don't have a parent with Greek citizenship to be recognized. Tsikas says there were other problems too. Tsikas says, as a black man, Adetokounmpo was often the target of racism. He avoided going out at night so he wouldn't be attacked. And then at home, he was often hungry. The family was poor, and everyone pitched in to get by. And Adetokounmpo's mother would clean houses, and he and his siblings would sell things on the streets. He told CBS's Steve Croft about those days in an interview in 2018.
They used to sell CDs, DVDs.
You must be a pretty good salesman.
I was the best.
The best?
Yeah. I was really good at it.
What was your secret?
I didn't give up. I was...
Basketball became an escape for Adetokounmpo. He'd hit the court in his neighborhood, and that's where he was actually discovered by a Greek basketball coach who took him under his wing and first helped him get on an amateur team. And then in front of scouts. In June 2013, Adetokounmpo was invited to attend the NBA draft in New York, but he didn't have a passport and there was no way for him to go. This is actually when the Greek government stepped in, gave him documents, a passport, and Greek citizenship. Then,
the Milwaukee Bucks select Giannis Adetokounmpo.
Back in the neighborhood of Sepolia, Salam Mohammed is privately celebrating the win as he works cleaning cars in the scorching heat. Mohammed came to Greece from Pakistan a decade ago. He says the challenges Adetokounmpo faced still very much affect people like him. But for the last few years, he says Adetokounmpo's success has given him hope. And this latest superhuman performance and victory is, at the very least, going to get him through today. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. More than 11,000 Olympic athletes are headed to Japan, 33 different sports, 339 events in total. Over time, new events get added while others get dropped. The world's Bianca Hillier looked back at events of Olympics past and the people working to keep them alive today.
Oh, they're away, and Gatlin got away brilliantly, and he's ahead of the field at the moment. And
Olympic sports are usually packed with action.
Bolt storming through, he takes it again, Blake gets the silver.
It's a big part of why billions of people tune in to the games. But some events from back in the day look a little different.
Yeah, it's pretty kind of boring watching somebody just floating along the surface, you know?
That's Dave Parrington, the head diving coach at the University of Tennessee. He's talking about an event called Plunge for Distance, which had its one and only Olympic appearance in 1904. It's pretty simple. Dive into a pool and travel as far as you can in 60 seconds without moving your arms or legs.
And also without breathing. It was just floating and gliding. So they had to get a really good angle of entry into the pool and just see how far they could go.
It turns out divers could go pretty far. Parrington's grandfather, Frank Parrington, from England, holds the world record for plunging 86 feet and 8 inches. That's the length of nearly 6 cars. The sport was passed down through the family, and even now, decades later, Dave Parrington still works it into his own swimming workouts from time to time.
I think I got up to about 65 feet, which wasn't too bad considering my current age. And I couldn't last the 60 seconds without a breath.
Parrington says, although he'd love it, he doesn't expect Plunge for Distance to return to the games. But he rejects the idea that it's an effortless sport. He says the best plungers had strong legs and shoulders. They were also nicely buoyant.
Because you're floating, gliding, and once you come up to the surface, you want to maintain on the surface, so you need to have a little bit of extra body fat.
Plunge for Distance isn't really around anymore, but other discontinued Olympic sports are still popular, like the gym class special, rope climbing.
A lot of people hate it. Because during gym class, every teacher wants them to climb, and a lot of people can't.
Tomas Filip is part of an organization that runs rope climbing competitions in the Czech Republic. The sport has a rich history there, he says, because of Bedřich Supčík, a Czech athlete who won the rope climbing event at the 1924 Games in Paris.
And it was the first gold medal for our republic.
Rope climbing was last seen on the 1932 Olympic stage. Participation dwindled for decades, but it picked up again in the 90s. Filip says now, in the Czech Republic, about 100 people still compete in rope climbing every year.
The rope climbing is quite a special sport because you have to be strong.
Really strong. Still, it's not considered a professional sport, so Filip says it's unlikely to make it back to the Olympics. But another backyard favorite might have a better chance, tug of war.
A lot of people like it. Everybody knows tug of war because everybody has played it or is playing it at school or whatever.
Maika Hornstra is the Secretary General of the Tug of War International Federation. She's competed in tug of war at the World Games 5 times, but the sport hasn't been seen at the Olympics since 1920.
We were removed from the program because of the IOC wanted to reduce the number of sports and the number of athletes.
But athletes haven't stopped competing. 77 countries are now part of the International Federation. Hornstra says the formal sport is similar to what many have done at parties and festivals, but there are rules and a judge and special shoes.
We have special boots and they are prepared with an iron heel. So you have an iron plate under your heel to have more grip in the soil.
Hornstra says tug of war is popular in Japan, so the federation tried their best to get the sport back into the Olympics this summer. It didn't happen. Now they're focused on making the 2028 Games in Los Angeles. Until then, Hornstra and others will proudly pull in tug of war matches in arenas where they are welcome, under the Olympic rings or not. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In 2004, the city of Liverpool in the UK was named a UNESCO World Heritage Site, recognition that Liverpool's port was once one of the biggest hubs of trade and commerce in the world. Today, UNESCO announced that they are revoking that status. Recent plans to redevelop Liverpool's waterfront, including construction of a soccer stadium, could damage the dock's historic character. That's the concern. Joining us now is Michael Parkinson. He's a professor at the University of Liverpool and recognized in the UK for his work on urban regeneration. Michael, what do you make of UNESCO's decision? Do you think the planned redevelopments are a threat to the city's historic waterfront?
Absolutely not. Bramley Moor Dock is derelict. It's next to a large sewage plant. No one can get in. It's been derelict for 50 years. Everton Football Club intend to invest and protect the heritage of the site, things which are actually at risk of falling down. These are matters of judgment and interpretation. They're not yes or no, but in my judgment and my interpretation, their decision is flawed.
I was struck by comments from the Metro Mayor of the Liverpool City Region, Steve Rotherham, who said UNESCO essentially wanted to, and this is his quote, preserve our region in aspic. Is that a feeling you share?
Yes, look, Liverpool is not a museum. It's not a mausoleum. It's a living, growing city. UNESCO always has, it's got 1,200 sites. It always has problems when they are in living big cities because the development pressures are obviously clearly different there from when you're talking about natural sites or monuments, okay? So they're not well set up to deal with city sites, and they often have challenges. And in fact, they chucked Dresden out several years ago because they had to build a bridge to relieve commercial pressure. 5 years ago or 10 years ago, UNESCO said Liverpool must not build anything new on that site until they had agreed our plans. Well, that's A, unsustainable for a city trying to recover from economic crisis, and B, is incompatible with national planning legislation. Their view of the city competes with our view of the city. And at the end of the day, you have to ask, whose vision is right? The people who live there, who work there, who care for it, or an international organization? And I have to say, I've tried to find evidence, real hard evidence, of economic value flowing from being a World Heritage Site. It's very hard to find that evidence.
I was going to ask you, if you were to add it all up, do you think there's more revenue from visitors coming to Liverpool to see its port and waterfront, or from the people coming to see like the sites the Beatles made famous, like the Cavern Club?
Look, there are 1,200 World Heritage Sites. There's one Liverpool. It is globally known. Beatles, football, waterfront, transatlantic trade, emigration, writers, painters, people come for that. And when we take away the site, as from today, nobody will stop coming. If you visit the city, if you saw the place, you met the people, you saw the waterfront, you saw the buildings, you would say, it's just absurd to say Liverpool should be cut off. There's a old Scouse saying, which is, on your bike to UNESCO, we're done with this.
Michael Parkinson is a professor at the University of Liverpool who is recognized nationally in the UK for his work on urban regeneration. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's been a great pleasure.
You're listening to The World. It's been a brutally hot summer across much of the U.S., hard for all of us, but especially hard for farm workers.
Farm workers are 35 times more likely to die from a heat-related death compared to other occupations.
Many are immigrants who toil in the heat, basically running a fever, with few regulations to protect them. Their story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Rockets landed in Kabul yesterday. No serious injuries were reported, but it was another reminder of the worsening security situation in Afghanistan as U.S. troops are completing their withdrawal from the country. From Kabul, The World's Shirin Jafari reports on the mood in the capital city.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani was among those taking part in prayers to mark the Muslim celebration of Eid al-Adha. The group of officials were mid-prayer when several rockets landed not far away near the presidential palace.
Allah.
Only one man in the group of worshippers left the scene. Everyone else continued praying as if nothing had happened. About an hour after the rocket attack, people in Kabul were busy going about their day. It's like so many incidents have happened here, there is barely time for people to take much notice. Just a few minutes' drive from where the rockets landed, an impromptu open-air market is buzzing with customers. Cows, sheep, and goats are here for sale. And it's especially busy today because Muslim families usually sacrifice animals for the big holiday feast. 65-year-old Khala Gol is selling a black and white cow. His tan, wrinkled face glistens in the sun as he speaks. Life is miserable, he tells me. There's no work, there's no money. His friend joins in the conversation and agrees. Khala Gol raises cows in Helmand province in the south. It's easier and cheaper that way. Then, when it's time for the Eid celebrations, he brings them here to the capital where he can sell them for a higher price. A cow goes for about $500 to $1,500, depending on its weight and health. This year, Khalagol says he had a lot of problems getting his animals to Kabul. There is intense fighting between the Taliban and Afghan security forces. Highways that connect provinces can be nothing short of a death trap. Khalagol says the Taliban fighters he saw along the way were heavily armed. They had AK-47s and rockets, he tells me. They also made him pay taxes for the cow. Taxes are a major source of revenue for the Taliban. Further down the market, Khanzada, who's 19, says people don't get a break from the fighting. He too almost died getting his livestock from Helmand to Kabul. What kind of life is this? He asks. All we want is to live in peace, he says. Khalagol and Khanzada have a long experience with war. Khalagol was a young man when the Soviets left Afghanistan in the 1980s. Shortly after that, the country descended into a civil war. Khanzada was born a year after the U.S. war in Afghanistan began. Now, almost two decades later, he says, people are worried about yet another civil war. Besides livestock for slaughter, people also buy candies and nuts to celebrate Eid. Mushtaq is a candy store owner in Kabul. When I ask about security, he says the reason that the Taliban is taking over territory fast is not because people support them. They're brutal, he says. His colleague Asibullah chimes in. As long as Pakistan supports the Taliban, the war here will continue, he says. Pakistan provides the group with money, arms, and a safe haven. Afghan officials have long complained about that, the fact that Taliban leaders are based in Pakistan. In recent weeks, videos have surfaced online showing Taliban fighters getting treatment at hospitals inside Pakistan. And earlier this week, the Afghan government withdrew its diplomats from the country after the ambassador's daughter was allegedly kidnapped and beaten. Asibullah, who works at the candy shop, has a bachelor's degree in economics. He says the younger generation, people like him, have no interest in the harsh Islamic rule that the Taliban want to bring to Afghanistan. If they do come to power, he says, I won't stay here. I'll run away to another country. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari in Kabul.
In summer months, ice cream typically brings people together. But in Israel right now, ice cream is divisive, specifically Ben & Jerry's. Since the Vermont-based ice cream maker said on Monday afternoon that it would no longer sell its ice cream in Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, the blowback hasn't stopped from many sides. Israeli journalist Noga Tarnopolsky reports on Israel and the Palestinian territories and joins us from Jerusalem. Noga, what did Ben & Jerry's say in their statement exactly?
Well, what Ben & Jerry's said is that they believe it's inconsistent with the company values to be sold in the occupied Palestinian territories, and that they have heard the concerns of their fans and trusted partners. And then they also add that although Ben & Jerry's will no longer be sold in the occupied territories, they will stay in Israel through a different arrangement. They're looking for a new franchisee.
So how did Israel's politicians respond to this news? I see it's gone up to the prime minister's office.
And beyond, yeah. I have to tell you, Israeli politicians have reacted, but as if the country were under the threat of war, more or less. The brand new Israeli president, who was sworn in, I think, 10 days ago, released a statement in which he referred to Ben & Jerry's decision as a form of terrorism, literally. And he said it's a kind of economic terror. He also referred to Ben & Jerry's decision as a boycott against Israel, which it explicitly is not. Ben and Jerry's, as a company, tried to make it really clear that they're not leaving the Israeli market, but that they don't want their products sold in the occupied Palestinian territories.
I mean, this is one ice cream brand. What is the Israeli government worried about? Do they see a snowball effect or something?
I wish I could answer. You know, I've been following this issue for more than a decade. In the last years of the Netanyahu administration, Israel turned to kind of a war against this notion of BDS, sorry, the boycott, sanction, and divest movement. And right now, it's hard for me to think of any other term other than hysteria. I don't know why there's this reaction. And it's bizarre given the reality, which is that BDS as a movement has failed completely and utterly to set out to do what it wanted to do. BDS, when it was formed some 15 years ago, set out to basically recreate the kind of pressure for divestment that existed in the 80s against South Africa and force companies to divest from Israel and basically destroy the country's economy. That was what they set out to do. And they've failed completely and totally on every level.
Since we're talking about BDS, I'm wondering if this is perhaps a victory for that movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Yes, I think it is without any doubt a victory for the BDS. I think a bigger victory than they even planned for, given the Israeli reaction, which is so exaggerated. But I have to tell you that, ironically, this is also a victory for the West Bank settler movement.
In what way?
Because while former Prime Minister Netanyahu's plan to annex parts of the West Bank to Israel failed, Netanyahu and his brand of politics have succeeded in kind of creating a reality in the Israeli mind in which the West Bank settlements are equivalent to Tel Aviv. They're the same as the rest of Israel. And that is quite something and quite a victory for the settlement leadership. They're an extreme minority of Israelis. So I would say those two sides of extremists can claim victory now.
I gather the U.S. State Department had something to say about this as well.
Believe it or not, the State Department didn't respond by mentioning Ben and Jerry's specifically, but they say that they oppose BDS as a matter of policy. They said that they refuse to address any actions of a private company, but more broadly, it said the United States firmly rejects the BDS movement, which unfairly singles out Israel.
How do you think this Ben and Jerry story stands as a cautionary tale to other companies that do business in this region, whether they choose to keep operating there or maybe stop doing business there?
So I think that this was a really brilliant move by the BDS movement, who exerted, this has, by the way, been a years-long campaign, and they really targeted Ben & Jerry's as a company that would be susceptible to this kind of pressure, and they succeeded. I don't know how many other companies would even be open to this sort of approaches. Let's say, you know, Intel has two major plants in Israel. I know that BDS have approached them in the past, but my understanding is that no one even responds to BDS activists' emails from Intel or, you know, Facebook, for example, has a big operation here. I've never heard of other company that is politically, I would say, committed in the way that Ben & Jerry's is.
Noga Tarnopolsky is an Israeli journalist and writer reporting on the Mideast. She's been speaking with us from Jerusalem. Noga, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Farm work is hard work. It doesn't stop, even in extreme heat. And this summer, that's what many farm workers across North America are dealing with. Roxana Chicas has seen firsthand the recent impacts of the heat in the fields and on farm workers. She's a nurse and assistant professor at Emory University School of Nursing in Georgia. So, Roxana, you're now in Florida speaking with farm workers. What are you learning?
We're doing a research study, and many of them are telling us how hot it is outside. Sometimes when they come into our office, you can feel like their body is just so hot. And it's very humid down here in Florida as well.
Well, one detail jumped out at me. Even when temperatures are moderately high, farm workers are essentially running a constant body temperature of over 100 degrees, a fever. So what other physical impacts does this kind of heat imply for farm workers?
So farm workers are 35 times more likely to die from a heat-related death compared to other occupations. And we have documented that they sometimes work with a fever, their core body temperature goes over the 100.4 Fahrenheit threshold.
And so many of them are chronically dehydrated. They suffer from heat-related illness symptoms. Some of them are even suffering from acute kidney injury.
I'm wondering what you've seen in your work as a nurse. Have you attended to patients who work in the fields?
Yes. So this morning, I just actually wrapped up the morning session where we're seeing workers before they go to work, getting blood and urine to see, you know, how from just one work shift, how their physiological blood and urine changes. Again, many of them come to our morning session really dehydrated and even further dehydrated at the end of the day. And some will also suffer from acute kidney injury just over, you know, one work day.
I mean, just to be clear, a lot of these farm workers don't really have a choice but to be working in the fields, correct?
Yes, that's right. Because many of the workers that we see are undocumented. And so this is their bread and butter. And this, they don't want to rock the boat. They don't want to say that their working conditions are harsh to their employer because, you know, they fear retaliation, that other growers will not hire them. And so they keep quiet and they continue to be exploited and work in really bad conditions.
As a nurse, Roxana, what led you to start looking at the immigrant farm working community and their working conditions?
Well, I'm an immigrant myself. My parents worked in the agricultural fields in El Salvador. And so I was also formerly undocumented. So I understand the vulnerabilities that come with not having legal status. And so in addition to the record-breaking temperatures that farm workers are exposed to, it's just the collision of both climate change and immigration or lack of immigration status coming together. And it's deteriorating farm worker health and also not really protecting them and protecting their human dignity.
Finally, Roxana, I'm wondering, when you go to the grocery store and you want to buy vegetables or fruit, how do you think about your purchases in relation to those farm workers? I mean, people still need to eat and those farm workers still need a wage, right?
You know, I think about the awful kind of rhetoric there's been around immigrants. And I think everyone benefits from undocumented labor. They're here to work and they provide food for our tables, and yet they have very little for themselves.
That's Roxana Chica. She's a nurse studying the impacts of heat on immigrant farm workers in the U.S. Roxana, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
One other challenge with these extreme weather events and connections to climate change, how do you describe it? Literally. Max Boykoff is a professor in environmental studies at the University of Colorado Boulder and is with the Media and Climate Change Observatory there. So I know some newsrooms are probing the root causes of floods and fires with questions like, are these extreme weather events driven by climate change? Is climate change making things worse? As you look at the weather-related news from the past few days, does anything strike you about the coverage in general?
You know, I think some of the national and international coverage has done a pretty good job of actually connecting these dots, of talking about the floods in central China, for instance, and the connections to a changing climate. Before that, just in this month, looking at the German and Belgian flooding that took place, connections had been made to climate change. But when we talk about regional and local news coverage, it is understandable that a lot of these journalists are generalist journalists. They're covering several different stories in a day. And to wade into the intricacies of the connections between extreme events and climate change may be difficult for them.
What about places like, I think of the Marshall Islands, you know, countries that are really literally on the shore's edge of sea rise? I mean, do you find that media coverage there is more focused on the why and the how?
Not necessarily, actually. I mean, there are some real constraints. We track, for instance, the Fiji Times, and we've looked at a lot of their coverage, and oftentimes they're relying on external international wire services like Reuters to be telling the stories out of Fiji. And so without providing more new resources in their newsrooms, it's difficult for them to be telling these stories to the people who live within Fiji and to international audiences who may want to hear about considerations around storm surge and sea level rise in places like Fiji.
So your observatory monitors news sources in around 60 countries around the world to measure climate change coverage. How has coverage of climate change been changing in the last year around the globe?
Overall, coverage has continued to increase this year. I mean, if you compare it to last year with the news coverage largely paying attention to the unfolding coronavirus pandemic, that makes some sense. But even comparing it to years past, in the main, news coverage of climate change or global warming continues to go up around the world.
So when people like news consumers are hearing about a weather tragedy or a climate tragedy someplace else, what questions should they be asking to understand why that event matters in the big picture?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll start by saying that some folks think of climate change as a single issue, and I think that's misplaced. Reframing this as something that intersects with just about every dimension of the way in which we live, work, play, relax, pray in society is the reframing that we need to take up. And so when people are asking questions, you know, how does, say, a heat dome over the Pacific Northwest or over British Columbia matter to me? They can start to see the linkages that these are happening in many other places around the world, that these then may intersect with trade. And so as we're seeing this, as we see the costs rack up, we can start to help people better understand. While they may be distant to a particular event like the floods in central China that you led with, that these are the kind of indications of things that are going to unfortunately continue to happen without concerted efforts going forward to address climate change.
Max Boykoff is a professor at the University of Colorado Boulder. He works with their Media and Climate Change Observatory. Max, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Marco. I appreciate it.
Today is known as Liberation Day in the U.S. territory of Guam, the day American forces invaded the island, retaking it from Japan at the end of World War II. For the indigenous people of Guam, or Guahon in the Chamorro language, it's complicated. Dakota Camacho has roots in Guam. They're a Seattle-based dancer and musician. In this installment of our series Movement, Stories at the Crossroads of Music and Migration, Dakota talks about the quest to understand their people's history and how that search led to their own style of hip-hop.
Usually before I start anything that I do, I take a moment to activate this practice that my people have around acknowledging those that came before us, whether that's the ancestors of the land or the water that we're passing through. And it's a song of gratitude and respect. Inne ni hamzu. Man yainan mami. My Nana and Papa, my dad's mom and dad, were born in 1924 and 1925. So at that time, the U.S. had called Guahan its colonial possession. And in 1940, they abandoned Guahan because they heard that the Japanese military was going to invade. My Nana was on Guahan at the time, but my Papa was not. At 15, he joined the military because that was the best way that he knew to provide for his family. So my pop actually spent World War II on a ship. He was a survivor of Pearl Harbor. My Nana survived the 4 years of Japanese military occupation. And the Americans decided to come back on July 21st, 1944. But when they did, they carpet bombed the island. And the Americans reinvaded, and they named this day Liberation Day. And the complex part about it is that some people felt liberated, and some people did not feel liberated because they thought, at least we knew where we stood with the Japanese. With the Americans, we don't know. So that is the life that my papa came back to, of basically having no money and no land. They decided to leave. So that's what brought me to live on this continent here. I grew up raised by a dad who was not taught his language specifically because my family wanted him to be able to live a life unharmed by the discrimination that they faced because of the accents that they have and their way of thinking and phrasing things. And I remember being, I don't know, it must have been like the seventh grade or something, trying to ask my Nana and Papa to teach me and my Dingat, my twin sister, our language. And we knew that they wanted to, but that they didn't really know how, or they didn't know where to start, that it was too late. And so we learned basically how to cuss people out and how to talk crap about people. And that was, it was important because it taught us that although they wanted us to be able to succeed in this world, they were also aware that other people's limitations were actually what was holding us back and not our own. I sit before my altar as I wake up in the morning.
give thanks for my ancestors presiding before me, bring attention to my breathing. I know it's time to enter the transit to the state of mind, spiritual surrender.
When I was in the 8th grade, I had a history teacher named Mr. Janello, and he welcomed us to U.S. history on the first day by saying, "Welcome to U.S. history. Take a look at the back of the room. Those are your history books. Don't touch them. They're dangerous." And then he passed us out the first chapter of A People's History of the United States. And in that chapter, we read Columbus's writings about the horrible things that he did to the Arawak people. And I started thinking to myself, my family's Catholic. Are we some of the people that did these horrible things? And then I came to find out that actually the horrible things that Catholic people did to the Arawak, many of them they did to our people. And it was depressing because the things that I was reading, which were primarily written by white historians, were saying that our language and our culture were dying, and, you know, that this tradition used to be in practice, but then the Spanish stamped it out. I mean, I was a devout Catholic. I was an altar server. I was the only teenager I knew that had an altar in my room where I would pray the rosary. And I was still, like, really struggling with all these questions. And I found out that my ancestors had different sets of beliefs. And I also knew that my family couldn't teach me about it. And I also, even though I struggled with my belief in God, I really believed in spirit. I really believed in something that's greater than me. And so I started asking my ancestors for guidance of how to get to know about this world. And I learned about this form of poetry that my ancestors practice, which they called in the writing Cantan Samarita. And it is a form of rhyming, improvisational, freestyled, like kind of competitive, allegorical, metaphorical wordplay. And I was like, I feel like I'm doing this with some of my friends at lunch, you know? And so I was like, well, I can't speak my language, but I can speak the language of rhyme.
Voices speaking from the altar where the rosaries are found, foreign to a young Yahadza whose soul has been around. Does the spirit care for difference, or does it distance exhibit unity? Because beauty means specific characteristics of creators.
You know, I was like, oh my God, like there's a world in which I can exist. There's a world in which I can exist. So that's what grew me into connection to hip hop.
Everything I do, I stand on my land. Give thanks to my roots, I stand on my land. I always speak the truth, I stand on my land. Everywhere I am, I stand on my land.
One of the things that I've been trying to make sense of recently is, what is the role of a creator, of a song maker, of a singer for indigenous peoples? You know, the things that I've learned over the years is it's an oral historian. It's somebody who also can use song as a way to generate an opportunity for healing.
Very personal discovery there. That was musician and dancer Dakota Camacho. Their story was part of our series Movement, Stories at the Crossroads of Music and Migration, produced by McLeet Hadero and Ian Koss. Find a Spotify playlist with music from the artists we featured in Movement and their stories at theworld.org/movement. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. We'll see you tomorrow.